Well, you know, if you pick up Newsweek this week and you look at the cover, nothing there really offensive. I mean, you've got this beautiful picture of the Madonna with child. Whoever's choosing their art's doing a great job. This is a marvelous picture. The birth of Jesus. And then it starts to kind of fall apart. Faith and history, how the story of Christmas came to be. So what are we dealing with? Two different things, faith and history, or are they coterminous, faith and history? What the Gospels deliver to us, and we're talking here in particular about Matthew's Gospel and Luke's Gospel, by way of the nativity story, the Christmas story, is it just the fanciful or pious longings of people who, in retrospect, thought, you know, that Jesus character, he was a great teacher and a mighty prophet, and some of us even mistakenly believe he's the Messiah. Maybe we need to bolster his resume a little bit with a miraculous birth. Or is it history? How does it read? We'll talk about that during this first hour of Issues Etc. with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. We'll also be discussing with Dr. Montgomery the Supreme Court of Canada's endorsement today of gay marriage. We'll find out what happened in Canada. In the second hour of the program today, we'll be talking with Pastor Ed Balfour about Hanukkah. He's a convert to Lutheranism from Orthodox Judaism. It's always good to have Eddie on the program. We'll be talking with him about the Festival of Lights. Feel free to join us, by the way, anytime during this 2.5 hours of Issues Etc. today. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And we will also get a Canadian perspective on the Supreme Court of Canada's endorsement of gay marriage today from Dr. Ed Kettner, who is academic dean at Concordia Lutheran Seminary in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We'll find out what he has to say about it from the other side of the border. Then, in the last half hour of the program, did you get a chance to see last night's Scarborough Country? It's MSNBC, so most people have an opportunity to watch this if you have cable. Joe Scarborough was gone. Pat Buchanan was sitting in for him. That was not very notable. What was notable is the exchange. It was the heading, Moore or Gibson? Oscars, Moore or Gibson? They were asking the question, will Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, will it get an Oscar? Now, they had a couple panelists there. Bill Donahue, a couple others. Rabbi Shmuley Boteach as well. And we're going to be playing some of the exchanges with the rabbi in the third part of Issues Etc. today, the last 25 minutes, and get your reaction to it as well. They all agreed on cultural and social issues, but man, did they disagree on that Passion of the Christ. We'll hear what the rabbi had to say in the last part of Issues Etc. today. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. He's a regular guest. He's professor emeritus at the University of Luton in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales. He's a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. And he's authored and edited more than 50 books, including History, Law, and Christianity. Dr. Montgomery, thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Canada's Supreme Court is the first issue I want to take up with you. Today, they said it was okay for the legislature of Canada to redefine or define as it may be, marriage to include people other than men and women, respectively. Your initial reaction?
Well, this is only an advisory opinion. It doesn't determine the issue. It leaves the issue up to the voters in Canada. But it's a further example of the sad liberal state of the Canadian Supreme Court. We've known this for years. The Canadian Supreme Court is probably the broadest that we can find anywhere, and this is a further example of the fact that they really don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they're doing. For example, they have argued in the opinion that if marriage were to be restricted, as it has been, to two people of opposite sex, then this would be a violation in some sense of equality rights. Now, the logic of this is just silly. It's just silly. It is no violation of equality not to allow everyone to do anything that any single person can do, that any one person can do. It is not discriminatory at all to say that just because one person or a couple can do something, that therefore absolutely anyone else should be able to do that same sort of thing. For example, there are people who can fly jet planes. Suppose I were to argue that the fact that I am not given the right to fly a jet plane is a violation of equality rights. They are not treating me decently. They are not letting me get behind the wheel of a jet plane or the stick of a jet plane and fly it. Of course, the fact of the matter is that if I were allowed to do this, it would be a destructive mess all the way around. Likewise, not everyone can do brain surgery. Not everyone can drive a car. The fact of the matter is that the concept of marriage is such that you need to have people of opposite sex in order to understand the nature of it. The fact that people who are of the same sex are not allowed to do this doesn't in any way violate equality. But that's an example of the kind of sloppy reasoning that you get in this decision.
Now, so we're really talking here not about whether or not restricting the definition of marriage to a man and a woman is discrimination. We're really saying, is it proper or improper discrimination? Because discrimination takes place all the time in the law, as you have just said.
Oh, very definitely. Another example of very poor reasoning on the part of the court is the statement that the recognition, I'm quoting, the recognition of same-sex marriage in several Canadian jurisdictions, as well as in two European countries, belies the assertion that marriage should be available only to opposite-sex couples, unquote. Now, that is the logical fallacy of consensus gentium or consensus gentium, that simply because people agree on something, that makes it right. The fact that two European countries happen to have allowed same-sex marriage doesn't in any way make it right. This is as illogical as to say that just because there is an increase in the number of bank robberies, robbing banks is gradually becoming all right. It's confusing the is with the ought. The fact that people do certain things is not the same thing as justifying those things.
Now, you are not wont to prognosticate on this program, Dr. Montgomery, but I wonder, since this pretty much puts into the hands of the voters in the legislature in Canada the issue of whether or not they want gay marriage and whether or not it ought to be. In fact, there is a bill that is going to be introduced in the legislature there to basically put a bow on this whole issue in favor of redefining marriage to include someone other than a man and a woman. What do you think will happen in Canada?
I think there's a decent chance that that they will allow same-sex marriage. There have been surveys which seem to indicate that roughly 51% of the voters are opposed by 49% on this issue. I mean, it's so close that it could very well come about. I lived in Canada for 3 years. I was the head of the history department at the former Waterloo Lutheran University, now Wilfrid Laurier University. And I'm sure Canadian listeners will not appreciate my saying this, but I found a great deal of instability in the Canadian mind. Canadians seemed not to have a great sense of personal identity. They had great difficulty deciding whether they wanted to be like people in the United States or whether they wanted to be like people in England. There was a cultural instability there, and that has often been accompanied by a moral instability. They've not gotten a clear set of values, and maybe this is due to the fact that they have had difficulty in identifying themselves as members of the British Commonwealth, and yet at the same time so close to America. There's the the humorous question, what is it like being a Canadian? And the answer to this is, it's like being in bed with an elephant. Even if it doesn't turn over, you're always wondering if it might.
Now, you don't mind if I give out your email address a little later into the program to all our Canadian listeners?
Better not do it. Better not do it.
A couple last questions on this very issue. First of all, the headlines are generally reading, Supreme Court of Canada, okay, same-sex marriage, protects religious freedom. That is, the churches of Canada will not be forced to perform unions against their beliefs. And someone might say, hey, then we got nothing to worry about. Christians of goodwill ought not be worried about such a bill. What do you say?
Well, of course, it's fortunate that they are not violating religious freedom by insisting that clergy perform same-sex ceremonies. But the problem with this kind of thing is that if this takes place, a same-sex couple can refer to their relationship as a marriage on precisely the same level as a heterosexual marriage, then, of course, it's going to be possible for them to adopt children, and the social fabric will be deeply flawed as a result of this. Children will grow up in a really bizarre kind of environment, and that, in turn, of course, will spill over to future generations. The family is a bulwark of society, the traditional family. The problems with homosexual relationships is, of course, that these don't require they don't have the kind of demands placed upon them that exists in a heterosexual situation. In a heterosexual situation, the differences between the two sexes have to be reconciled in the context of the family, and the child is the beneficiary of this, where a child grows up in a context other than that, the child suffers as a result of it, and the society inevitably suffers because, obviously, these children become adults and will influence the tone of that entire culture.
Have you ever thought about writing a parenting book? That was a brilliant insight that the children are the beneficiaries of the reconciling of the obvious differences between husband and wife, father and mother. I don't think I've heard that anyplace else.
Well, I very much appreciate that. The reason why I don't do books along this line is that every time I go into a Christian bookstore, I find such perfectly obnoxious material along that line that I get sick, and then I get back to something more substantial like apologetics.
Okay, a few more questions. If there is Canadian gay marriage, will the U.S. benefit in only this backhanded way, and that is they will get to watch their neighbors to the north play out the obvious legal and social scenarios that will flow from legalizing gay marriage?
Well, to a certain extent. Of course, we've already had a bit of this with the situation in New England. As a result of the one state there, isn't it Massachusetts?
Yes.
That has allowed this kind of thing. In other states, they've had the delightful situation of a same-sex married couple already at each other's throats and desperately wanting a divorce in another state where the original marriage has not been recognized. And this has created all sorts of bizarre legal battles. Of course, this is rather nice for the lawyers, but not for anybody else. There's no doubt about the fact that if this does take place in Canada, we will be seeing all sorts of very strange consequences, and that may influence the way in which American states deal with this. Although America, the United States, is much more conservative, the degree of serious religious commitment is much greater in the United States, so that there is, I think, a very little chance that the Supreme Court of the United States would ever take this route that the Canadian Supreme Court has taken.
Ordinarily, a marriage performed in Canada for Canadian citizens, if they were to come to the United States and seek citizenship here or take up residence as dual citizens, would be valid. What about a gay marriage performed in Canada?
Well, there is every possibility that that would have to be recognized in terms of public international law. Public international law in regard to polygamous marriages declares, and this is binding on countries that have ratified the treaties relating to this, in those instances, even though the polygamous marriage could not be performed, for example, in England, a polygamous marriage is recognized as valid if it's valid according to the state in which it was originally performed. Okay, so that would not, however, mean that the tax benefits would accrue to such a same-sex marriage, but it would mean that the couple could not be regarded as engaged in some sort of a male prostitution or female prostitution situation. They would have to be recognized as benefiting from whatever status they had obtained in the country where this was performed.
Very briefly then, Dr. Montgomery, how does a Christian at work in the marketplace of ideas make the case against gay marriage to a coworker there in the public square?
The best way to go about this, it seems to me, is to use good psychological and sociological materials which show that homosexual relationships are less satisfactory even for the couples involved than a heterosexual relationship, and that homosexuality is generally a product of psychological pressures such as a very strong mother and a very weak father, and that these relationships are not stable. They break up very, very frequently, and by arguing along those lines, I think we can get the non-Christian at least to raise a question about this. And then we can take the person to Holy Scripture. And if it's possible, of course, to bring the person to faith in Jesus Christ, then the person is going to want to look at the world through the same eyes that our Lord did. And that means accepting what Scripture says about all this. And Scripture says that marriage is limited to a man and a woman.
Here is the first poll quote from the Religion. This is the cover story of Newsweek this week, The Birth of Jesus. It says, from Mary to the manger, how the Gospels mix faith and history to tell the Christmas story and make the case for Christ. What do you make of this this framing of the question, mixing faith and history?
Well, it assumes, of course, that the gospel materials are not thoroughly historical. And that comes out all the way through this very, very poor article by John Meacham. Incidentally, in Dante's Inferno, at the very center of the Inferno, we have encased in ice Brutus, Cassius, and Judas. I've always felt that journalists ought to be right there at the center, encased in ice, along with those three traitors.
Some would say attorneys, too, Dr. Montgomery.
Oh, no, 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 not at all. The problem with the journalist is that the journalist is grinding out material without carefully investigating the material. He runs while he reads, and that's true throughout this Newsweek article. It is a superficial pastiche of quotations, none of them coming from Bible-believing scholars, by the way, all of them from people who don't believe that the Scripture is historically sound. Faith rises properly from fact, and if you try to slosh together some kind of independent belief that doesn't have any factual foundation and historical fact, the end result of this is an indigestible stew.
Now,
it'll make you sick religiously.
The basic premise, it appears, of the Newsweek treatment of the birth of Christ, and it's based, as you have said, largely upon not only poor journalism but also poor scholarship when it comes to the New Testament, is that there was an historical person, Jesus, and that he was born, obviously, but the manner of his birth depicted in Matthew and Luke is an attempt to, what, well, in the words of the article, strengthen the tenuous claim that Jesus was the Messiah. Is there any evidence, with regard to those texts of Matthew and Luke, that this is what's taking place here, a retroactive attempt to strengthen the claims that Jesus was the Messiah?
None whatsoever. This material appears in exactly the same documents as everything else we know about Jesus. And therefore, to try to say that the material dealing with the virgin birth is a later, comes later and actually is read back in to support something else is completely gratuitous. There's not a whit of evidence about this. If, you know, I believe it was, don't think it was C.S. Lewis, another English writer said, it was Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton said, you know, it's very interesting that that people question the virgin birth because it's only in Matthew and Luke. But the same people who question the virgin birth never question the Sermon on the Mount, which is only in Matthew and Luke. What you have here is an anti-miraculous prejudice, that this kind of thing simply couldn't have taken place, and therefore an attempt is made to explain it away.
We're talking with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, and we've moved on to the issue of this week's Newsweek cover story on the birth of Christ, getting his reaction and his response to much of what you'll find in Newsweek this week. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is professor emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He also serves as distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. And he's author and editor of more than 15 books, including History, Law, and Christianity. He is also the professor in residence for the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, as well as the director of that academy. That academy is held each summer in Strasbourg, France. Now, if you'd like a free information brochure on the 10th Annual European Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, and that's for the summer of 2006 because 2005's all full up, simply call us at 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. It's our automated resource line, and we'll send you a free brochure for the 10th Annual European Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, 1-800-737-0172. 0172. By the way, that summer they will be talking about many of the things we're discussing in this conversation. So you get a more, far, far more in-depth discussion with Dr. Montgomery and the professors there who are serving at that academy in person at the 2006 European Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation for the next 25 minutes with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on the Newsweek article on the gospel accounts of Jesus' birth. Are they simply fanciful and pious longings? That if we did have a Messiah, this would be a great way for him to be born. I want to turn to Luke's gospel in particular. Luke's pretty intent on saying that this is real history. We'll be back right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
St. Paul writes, "To the Galatian Christians, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, 'Cursed is everyone who is hung on a tree.'" Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for December traces the tree theme from Jesus' birth in a manger to his death on the tree of the cross for sinners. Beautifully illustrated and wonderfully Christ-centered, this children's book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours and ask for A Tree for Christmas, 1-800-325-3040. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, and look under the What's New section for the Issues Etc. book of the month for December, A Tree for Christmas. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
You would meet boys and girls who can understand the poverty and lack of comfort that greeted Jesus Christ upon his birth. This Global Minute invites you to pray for children in India and hear about the life-changing help they're receiving. Two girls living with their father and stepmother were forced to work as child laborers picking cotton. But their grandmother rescued them and led them to the Ramabai Mukti Mission, where they have teachers, a house mother, and other girls who now surround them with the love of Christ. Mukti welcomes girls and boys needing to escape traumatic situations and allows them to get an education while learning about Christ's love. Pray for more children in India to discover Christ's hope. See the inspiring story of Mukti on the free DVD or video, Buds and Blossoms. Call 1-800-268-0461. That's 800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. My lower back started to hurt. My neck felt strained because my body was in contortions God never intended. My hands were all gooked up. The shop vac, wrench, screwdriver, a channel lock, pliers, rags, all lying around. I grunted. I muttered. I almost cussed. Our toilet needed a new wax seal. That's the thing between the bowl and the floor that keeps the water from running onto the floor. So I said, what's a little water on the floor? A new floor would be nice. But because Diane is a dictator, I had to put on a new wax seal. That's the only way things get done around our house. Why would anyone ever become a plumber? I asked. For the money, she said. Grunt. You couldn't pay me enough to do this for a living. Ephesians 5 verse 20 says, sing and make music in your heart to the Lord, always giving thanks to God the Father for everything. Always giving thanks to God the Father for everything? Excuse me. But I did. Not for the contortions, the frustration, the gook, but for plumbers, and while I'm at it, for electricians, carpenters, and all you skilled tradesmen. You do more to help the rest of us in our daily lives than a whole boatload of preachers. Thanks for listening. I'm Dale Meyer.
AM 850 KFUO salutes our Church of the Week, King of Kings Lutheran Church in Chesterfield. Join King of Kings for their midweek Advent service Wednesday night at 7. There will be two Christmas Eve services, the family worship service at 5 p.m. and the candlelight and carol service at 10:30 p.m. King of Kings, located at 13765 Olive Boulevard in Chesterfield, our AM 850 KFUO Church of the Week.
We're talking about this week's Newsweek cover story on the birth of Christ with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. Folks, I'll tell you, Dr. Montgomery is joining us from France, and telephone calls to and from France are not cheap. Dr. Montgomery is not a cheap date or a cheap guest in that sense. And it's one of the things that if this is a prudential spending of our money. We could call it good stewardship and your support of issues, etc., but for it to continue and to expand as well. If you enjoy these conversations with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, do bear in mind that there are costs related to these conversations. They don't come free, and that's why we always ask for your support of the gospel outreach of issues, etc. We have our Reformation Club. It's a monthly donor program, three levels, the confessor, the apologist, or the reformer, that you can choose from. The confessor is $25 a month, or a year-end gift of $250. The reformer is $50 a month, or a year-end gift of $500, or the apologist is $100 a month, or a year-end gift of $1,000. If you want to see the benefits of the confessor, the apologist, or the reformer, you can go to page 11 of our latest Issues Etc. journal, or go to our website, issuesetc.org, and look under the What's New section. Now, in addition to all of this, and in just a moment, I'll give you a phone number and a mailing address for how you can join. In addition to all of this, here at the end of this year, we are looking for a one-time gift of $39,000 to Issues, etc. This is so that we can expand the weekday program to XM Satellite Radio. The weekend program, the Sunday Night National Edition, is already on XM Radio. What we'd like to do is bring the weekday 5 hours a week. That's 1 hour every 5 days, Monday through Friday, on XM Satellite Radio nationwide. They're holding a place for us there on XM for the next hour, the 4 to 5 hour Central Time on XM Satellite Radio for Issues, etc. And we can do it with a gift of $39,000 to issues, etc. You can call 1-800-737-0172 to donate by credit card. 1-800-737-0172. Or you can write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117, or go to our website and donate online, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. Now, if any of those levels are too great for you, and if $39,000 is too great for you, it's too great for me, just remember, no gift is too small. 1-800-737-0172. And Dr. Montgomery, since you are our official Issues Etc. legal affairs correspondent, we had this budget meeting. We've decided to double your salary for next year.
Oh, that's wonderful. Of course, 2 times 0 doesn't come to much more than 0, but that's just to show you what a good mathematician I am.
In addition to the legal mind, he can also do his multiplication as well. Dr. Montgomery, there is a survey that's laid out in the Newsweek story that seems to be good news in so much of the bad news of this Newsweek story about Jesus' birth, and that is that 84% of Americans consider themselves Christians, 82% see Jesus as God or the Son of God, 79% say that they believe in the virgin birth, and 67% think that the Christmas story, from the angel's appearance to the Star of Bethlehem, in its details, is historically accurate. Are you encouraged?
Well, yes, certainly it's good that those percentages exist, but it's very strange to me that anyone would consider himself a Christian and not go along with the account that we have historically of Jesus. I mean, if Christianity is Christ, then we are hardly in a position to question this stuff, and there is a marvelous historical backup for the soundness of all of this. As we've said, the accounts of Jesus' birth are contained in exactly the same records as everything else we know about Jesus. And if he rose again from the dead, and we have a wonderful firsthand testimony to the resurrection, if that's the case, then there is no sound reason for any Christian to doubt the accounts as they're set forth. Now, of course, people like our Newsweek writer, not being a Christian, goes all over the map trying to find some way to explain this stuff away. And the way you do this, of course, is to find authoritative opinions, in quotation marks, authoritative opinions of people who likewise are not believers in Jesus and who pay little attention to the historical material. This article includes quotations, for example, from Robert Miller and also from various liberal Roman Catholic writers such as Raymond Brown, which are entirely off the wall. There's Miller saying that there were birth stories of pagan heroes like Alexander the Great and Caesar Augustus, and so obviously the story of Jesus is like that. My goodness, even the writer of this Newsweek article has to admit, and I quote, "Scholars of antiquity have yet to find another example that precisely mirrors the Annunciation." Why? Because Mary had no sexual contact of any kind, whereas these stories of pagan antiquity always involve some kind of sexual activity, some kind of sexual deviation of one kind or another, in the case of Augustus, Caesar, or whoever. And in the case of Raymond Brown, finds the census in Luke's story, indeed the entire story as Luke sets it forth, is dubious on almost every score. Dubious on almost every score, no census. If listeners to this broadcast go to the New Bible Dictionary, that's the English production edited by J.D. Douglas, and if you look up the article on census and also the article on Quirinius, who conducted the census, both of these articles are written by F.F. Bruce, the Rylands Professor of New Testament Exegesis at the University of Manchester, the late F.F. Bruce, the author of the New Testament documents, Are They Reliable? And Bruce supports the census, the existence of the census, and supports Quirinius' governorship at the time. He stands leagues above the kind of people that the Newsweek article quotes.
Now, it's interesting. I mentioned before the break Luke's prologue, and Luke seems to be intent upon impressing upon his readers that he is writing a thoroughly researched and historical account. There is not a hint in Luke's prologue that he's engaging in any kind of exaggeration or hyperbole or mixing, quote-unquote, faith and history. Luke, let's just grant for a moment to the skeptical scholars that Luke wrote late. Even if he wrote as late as the skeptical scholars would have him writing his gospel, couldn't a made-up census in the entire Roman world have been easily shown to be a lie?
Well, of course. And no one will place Luke's gospel after the fall of Jerusalem, for goodness sake, and therefore there are going to be people alive who were present at the time of the ministry of Jesus. And when the Newsweek article says, after all, we don't get this information about Jesus' birth as firsthand testimony, unlike the public ministry and the passion of Christ, my goodness, where do they think this did come from? I mean, this stuff is circulating while Mary is still alive. Of course it was Mary and the people who had immediate contact with Jesus who were the source of this information.
There are two theories here that are laid out. One of them is rather minor in the Newsweek article, and that is that Jesus was illegitimate, and that in order to kind of cover up this embarrassing detail of his life, which was commonly known, and again, Brown is quoted with regard to a John passage there, that the whole miraculous birth seems, you know, a good way of saying, well, yeah, he didn't have a father that anybody knew about, but that's because his father was God. What do you make of that extrapolation?
Well, the only historical statement along this line comes from Celsus, the critic of Christianity, writing in 180 A.D. Now, that's worthless historically. That's 180 years after the event, for goodness sake. The fact that Celsus is trying to refute Christianity along that line doesn't provide any historical basis for affirming such a thing. We don't have any contemporary attempt to refute the virgin birth at all. And you would certainly have thought that the critics of Jesus during his own time would have brought that up if they had had any basis for doing so.
Matthew simply steps back to Isaiah 7, verse 14, about a virgin conceiving and giving birth to a son whose name will be Emmanuel. And this is where he draws upon for the Old Testament prediction of Jesus' birth, right there in the gospel. That is also called into question as kind of a retroactive patch job on the whole story. How do you respond?
Well, Raymond Brown uses this old canard that actually the passage doesn't necessarily mean virgin, it means young woman. But the fact of the matter is that when the Jews translated that Isaiah prophecy into Greek in Alexandria between about 300 and 100 B.C., in other words, well before the Christian era, they translated the Hebrew word alma, that's employed in the passage for virgin or young woman or whatever, they translated that by the Greek word parthenos, which can mean only virgin. Now that means that the Jews before the time of Christ themselves saw this as a passage dealing with a virgin birth, not a passage just referring to a young woman. Raymond Brown is, people kiss his foot, the hem of his garment. He is considered one of the greatest living Roman Catholic biblical scholars. This is just ghastly. It is awful scholarship. And why people listen to this crap is beyond me. Frankly, I read the Newsweek article on the web where it didn't cost me anything. Darned if I would have gone out and bought that issue.
Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Feel free to join our conversation via the email or our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Even among Christians, Dr. Montgomery, they will concede or be put in a position of conceding that there's no evidence for any of this. The best we have is just these gospel accounts, and that doesn't amount to evidence. How do you respond?
Well, just because the Gospels appear in India paper red letter editions has nothing to do with their historicity. We've mentioned F.F. Bruce. The New Testament documents, are they reliable? Bruce points out that the New Testament documents are the best attested documents of the ancient world. We have better manuscript authorities supporting them. We have a more consistent tradition of translation, and we have lectionary readings and quotations and this sort of thing so that we could virtually reconstruct them if we had only the early quotations from them. I mean, this is absolutely marvelous. Secular historians would give their eye teeth to be able to work with documents of this degree of stability. The reason that people question these documents is not their historicity. It's that they make them feel uncomfortable. There's nothing more uncomfortable than coming across the fact that you aren't God and somebody else is. You haven't been born of a virgin, and you haven't risen again from the dead, and therefore that's going to lower your status somewhat if you think that you are the universal cat's meow. What these documents do is to confront people with who God really is, and that in turn is going to force them to face the fact that they aren't God and that they desperately need salvation. And if people don't want to face that, then, of course, they've got to find some stupid rationalization to get out from under the pressure of all this.
Now, they might argue, Dr. Montgomery, that since the events that are recounted of Christ's miraculous birth have never occurred before or since, they cannot be true. They are singular occurrences and therefore highly unlikely.
Yes. Well, of course, every historical event is unique. We don't have Napoleon losing the Battle of Waterloo every day. Every historical event is different. Each individual is different from each other individual. The genetic chromosomal pattern that you have has not ever been duplicated in the history of the world, never will be. Therefore, to argue that any historical event can't have occurred because it's unique is a misunderstanding of the nature of uniqueness. I mean, obviously, this kind of thing is special. It is special. But we don't have a sufficient knowledge of the laws of nature so that we can say that any event can't happen. It's a open universe. And so all we can do is to investigate the evidence that exists for a given event. And if the evidence is strong enough, as it is in the case of the life of our Lord, then we've got to face the consequences.
And the argument that, look, you've got Matthew's account, and this is more particular than just only Matthew and Luke talk about it, but you've got Matthew's account, you've got Luke's account, and Matthew talks about some things that Luke seems to be unaware of, and Luke describes things that Matthew seems to be unaware of. Someone says it looks like they've got two conflicting accounts of this event.
Well, writers are never compelled to say everything. A writer selects what he feels is appropriate to make his point. And this is one of the strongest arguments for the soundness of the gospel records, that each of the writers is looking at these events from his own standpoint, and you don't have collusion going on here. You have the writers providing the information that will make the points that they're trying to make. In the case of Mark, it's a very, very short gospel. It was probably written for catechetical purposes, and therefore it doesn't give the detail that you get in the other Gospels. In the case of John, he is endeavoring to set forth the full theological panoply, and he starts out, of course, with Christ as the Word in eternity, and then when you come to Matthew and Luke, they are giving much more historical detail. Matthew, because he's writing to Jews, and Luke, because he's writing also to Jews, but to Hellenistic Jews, and so they provide this kind of thing. You can't a priori force all writers to say the same thing in exactly the same way.
The slaughter of the innocents is one of the accounts that is taken up in this Newsweek article as having no historical foundation. In fact, it says, though there is no historical evidence of this particular Herodian atrocity, Matthew's anecdote evoked the Passover saga for Jews hearing the story, linking Jesus with the idea of deliverance. What do you make of this?
Well, you don't need more than one historical narrative of a particular event, do you? I mean, is it the case, for example, that because we have only Einhard's biography of Charlemagne, that's the only biography, contemporary biography of Charlemagne, that Charlemagne probably never existed? Nonsense. As long as one account is a good one, then you go with it. You don't have to have others. We have very, very few of the official records of the Roman Empire. This is due to the fact that at the time of the barbarian invasions and the sack of Rome and the like, much of this material simply was destroyed. But that hardly means that when you come to a single event of the kind you're just talking about, that it didn't occur.
Another monkey wrench that's tossed in here is that if you look at the miraculous account of Jesus, you can find some parallels, in the events surrounding the birth of Isaac to Abraham and Sarah in the Old Testament. And it does sound like Matthew is trying to sound kind of Old Testament-ish. Luke has this shift after his prologue, where he begins to use very Old Testament language to describe the events around here. And someone says, look, they were just kind of recreating a very old story in Judaism for a modern-day prophet.
Well, they certainly were attempting to show that Jesus fulfilled Old Testament prophecy. Matthew has a staggering number of illustrations of this from the Old Testament. But that's not the same thing as constructing the life of Christ to fit the Old Testament prophecies. If that had been done, don't you think that the Jewish religious leaders who opposed Jesus would have been the first ones to point it out? I mean, they knew the Old Testament, and therefore they would have been able to show that this kind of thing wasn't the case at all. And the parallelisms are not that close in the case of the virgin birth. I mean, after all, when Sarah conceives at a very advanced age, there is no indication that it was a virgin birth.
We're talking with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery about the Newsweek cover story about the birth of Christ. Why do you think there is this yearly attempt, not only on the part of Newsweek, but Time's got their own version of this thing going that is, for all intents and purposes, identical in content? And perhaps U.S. News and World Report will take a whack at it, too. Other than the fact that it's obviously the Christmas season, why not do a cover story on, you know, the myth of Santa Claus and its origins? Why, at least lately, this yearly attempt to debunk not only the birth of Jesus, but at other times during the year, the entire account of Jesus' life, ministry, death, and resurrection?
Oh, that's easy. It sells magazines. If the survey that they have recorded is correct, then you've got a vast majority of people in the United States who regard themselves in some sense as Christian. And we know from the recent election that there is a powerful, powerful group of evangelicals in the United States, and these people are really concerned with questions of truth and values and that sort of thing. Now, if you present an article like this Newsweek article, people throughout the country are going to buy the magazine. They're going to buy it in a state of infuriation in many instances, but they're going to buy it anyway. An article on Santa Claus, I'm afraid, would not do this. And it's very interesting that these articles are invariably skewed in such a way that an imperceptive reader will see the pretty pictures and will see some of the nice things said about Jesus and won't feel too badly. And the people who are utter and out-and-out pagans will have their paganism supported. The article, incidentally, ends in the following fashion. The Christmas star is just one such light, one light toward peace. There are others. Whatever our backgrounds, whatever our creeds, many of us are in search of the kind of faith that will lead us through the darkness toward home. In Luke, the angelic host hails the Lord and then says, on earth, peace, goodwill toward men, a promise whose fulfillment is worth our prayers, not only in this season, but always. So, is anyone against peace? Surely not. Surely not. And whatever our background, meaning we want you to buy our magazine no matter what your religious position is. And after all, you can't be against peace, so you can't really criticize what we've done.
Very briefly, with only about 30 seconds here, Dr. Montgomery, how do we respond when someone says to us, you mean you really believe that whole virgin birth star angel story?
Well, my response to this is, I believe what is factually the case, and I can only discover what is factually the case by checking sound testimony. And the testimony in the New Testament to Jesus is that kind of testimony. It would hold up in any court of law. And the fact that there is a lot of mysterious stuff there only indicates that we're dealing with the God of the universe come to earth. You'd expect something special to accompany that, wouldn't you? And the real issue is, what are you going to do about it? If this did actually occur, then that means that when he said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, no man comes to the Father but by me, and believing in him is the only way to salvation, then we'd better come to terms with that personally.
Folks, you can order many of Dr. Montgomery's books, including History, Law, and Christianity, on the web at CILTPP.com. That's CILTPP.com. It's the website for the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy, CILTPP.com. Or you can call them at area code 780-461-3876. The book is called History, Law, and Christianity, 780-461-3876. Dr. Montgomery, thank you for being our guest.
Always a great pleasure.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England, a French advocate and barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States, Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and author and editor of more than 50 books, including that book I just mentioned, History, Law, and Christianity. When we come back from this break, Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., Pastor Eddie Balfour will be our guest, a convert to Lutheranism from Orthodox Judaism. We're going to talk about Hanukkah.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.